Everyone, welcome to session 258 of the Behavioral Observations Podcast. Dr. Alicia Halliday joins me to discuss the topic of profound autism. If you're not familiar with Alicia's work, she is the Chief Science Officer for the Autism Science Foundation and host of the excellent show, the ASF Weekly Science Podcast. In this episode, we discuss the changes in autism diagnoses from the DSM-4 to the DSM-5. We talk about the Lancet Commission paper on profound autism, why there is a need for this distinction in the autism spectrum, the conditions under which an individual would be classified as having profound autism, the estimated proportion of autistics who have profound autism, some interesting differences in the distribution of sex-based differences in profound and non-profound populations. We talk about person versus identity-first language. We spend a lot of time talking about the importance of reducing stigma for everyone with autism. We talk about criticisms of the proposal for profound autism and some responses to those criticisms. Even though we packed a lot into this interview, there's way more to this conversation than we had time for, so I'd like to revisit this again sometime in the future. In the meantime, if you're in the New England area, consider attending the Profound Autism Summit, which is taking place on April 5th, 2024 in Burlington, Massachusetts. Alicia will be speaking at that event and will go into even more detail than we did in this podcast. It's a multi-track conference that, according to the Profound Autism Summit site, aims to bring together leaders from the areas of research, medicine, treatment, advocacy, education, and human services to discuss the needs of those with profound autism across disciplines and throughout the lifespan. Even though the Profound Autism Summit features talks from notable behavior analysts like Drs. Greg Hanley, Shanna Barry, Peter Gerhardt, Jessica Slayton, and others, it's not just an ABA conference. There will be speakers and panelists representing advocacy groups, emergency services personnel, service providers, and more. For the complete list of speakers, as well as how to register and any other types of information, just go to the show notes for this episode, and I'll have all the details there. And the Profound Autism Summit is right around the corner, and it's almost sold out. So if you're on the fence, and if you're looking for some motivation, here it is. If you can't make it, consider signing up for the mailing list, as I believe they'll be making the talks available asynchronously sometime down the road. Before we get to the podcast, I want to let you know that we're brought to you by ACE-approved CEUs from, well, yours truly, Behavioral Observations. Well, not necessarily yours truly, but if you want to get CEs from some of your favorite guests, go to behavioralobservations.com and check out the eligible podcasts we have for ACE-approved continuing education. We're also brought to you by the University of Cincinnati Online. UC Online designed a Master's of Education in Behavior Analysis program that is 100% online and asynchronous. Want to learn more? Go to online.uc.edu and click the Request Info button. And last but certainly not least, we're brought to you by Behavior University, and their mission is to provide university-quality professional development for the busy behavior analyst. Learn about their CE offerings, their supervision courses, and RBT trainings over at behavioruniversity.com/observations. All right, that's it for opening remarks. So without any further delay, please enjoy this really informative and fun conversation with Dr. Alicia Halliday.
Welcome to the Behavioral Observations Podcast. Stimulating talk for today's behavior analysts. Now, here's your host, Matt Sikoria.
Dr. Alicia Halliday, thanks for joining me on the Behavioral Observations Podcast. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you? Thank you for having me on today.
It's a pleasure. And it's also a special treat to speak to a fellow podcaster. I know I've been binging on your episodes recently. And for those who don't know, you've been publishing a really wonderful podcast called the ASF Weekly Science Podcast. We'll get into I have some questions about the podcast itself.
Okay.
That we'll get to a little bit later. But first, I want to learn a little bit about you and your background. I usually start the show by asking guests I'm usually talking to behavior analysts. And I usually start the show by asking guests how they got into ABA and things like that, how they decided to pursue it as a career and so on and so forth. Your path is a little bit different. I think your background, and you can clarify the terms if I don't have them just right, but your background is more in the kind of cognitive neuroscience aspect of the broader psychology field, if you will. And so you have a little bit of a different background than most folks I talk to. So I guess I'll just reframe the question slightly and ask you, you know, how'd you get into doing that and what made you want to pursue that? And, you know, from there, kind of bring us up to speed to what you're doing these days.
Yeah, thank you. I am not a behavioral therapist. I wish I had that training. I don't. I started out in the area of pharmacology and toxicology, looking at animal models of, you know, different behavioral disorders using different environmental toxicants. One of them was mercury and methylmercury, as well as methamphetamine to look at neurodegeneration. So if you'll remember, in 1999, there was a theory posted or published about whether or not vaccines, the mercury in vaccines, was linked to autism. And of course, after this paper was published, the public and the community and the government was very motivated to determine if this was in fact the case. And there was a number of large grants that were awarded to universities. And the university I was at, Rutgers University and the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, was the recipient of one of these grants to look at the question. So I was looking at animal models of mercury exposure and methylmercury exposure and other environmental toxicant exposure and developing model systems for autism. At the same time, we were going into people's homes, collecting dust, water, you know, the chemicals that they used in their home, vacuum samples, really anything we could get to kind of think about what their toxicological environment was. And we went into people's houses. Their child had already been diagnosed with autism. We now know that the exposure, if there was one, had to have occurred during pregnancy, but we didn't really know that. We kind of thought, well, it's the exposure is timed with the onset of the behavioral features of autism. But anyway, that's how I got started with it. And I was at Rutgers University. An opportunity came up in 2005 for me to join the National Alliance for Autism Research, which then became Autism Speaks. And the opportunity would have allowed me, and it did, to work more directly with families and also with caregivers, with the community, with doctors, with researchers that were kind of outside the realm of just animal model researchers or just academia. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try this and see if I like it. And I loved it. So I've stayed. Of course, I'm not at Autism Speaks anymore. I'm at the Autism Science Foundation, but I've been doing this for about 25 years.
I see. I one of my favorite classes and one of my most difficult classes I took as a graduate student was behavioral toxicology. I was as listeners probably know, I was a grad student at Auburn University. And one of the big names in the field is a guy named Dr. Chris Newland.
I know him.
Oh, you know Chris, yeah.
Yeah, so I was for years and years and years, when I was a postdoc, when I was a graduate student, I was attending meetings like Society for Toxicology and Society for Neuroscience. And so it really wasn't until after I still work at Rutgers, or not work, but I have a honorary position at Rutgers and am involved in academics over there. But yeah, I mean, it was completely all these, but he's a very big name. You were very lucky to take a class from him.
Yeah, I could do a whole, I've been telling myself this for years and I still haven't managed to do it, but I got to have Chris on to talk more about this. And I could do a whole podcast about how Chris influenced a generation, probably more of individuals at Auburn University, many of whom didn't go into toxicology or pharmacology, but are just really good practitioners and clinicians and scientists in their own right, from that just kind of gauntlet, if you will, of rigorous academic preparation from the dreaded Chris Newland take-home test. And so I'll just leave that there for now. Okay. Maybe pick that up in another podcast. Okay. Putting Chris aside for a second, the main topic I want to chat with you about here is the whole, I guess, concept of profound autism. Mm-hmm. I think most folks will probably agree that this is a relatively new term, I suppose. And again, if I don't have that quite right, if this has been talked about for years and years and years, please let me know. But I understand there was a Lancet Commission paper that introduced the term profound autism a few years back. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you can speak to that paper and what is a Lancet Commission more generally? Because I know that it's not, you know, there are a number of these sorts of things that have, these Lancet Commission papers that have happened. And so if you can talk about kind of the introduction of the term profound autism, that would be a great starting point.
Yeah, so I'll have to go back a little bit to say that the definition of what autism is has changed, right? So for your listeners that maybe your listeners do know this already, the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for classifying and categorizing different mental disorders, their criteria for autism has changed over the years and changed due to science, right? What we know, there was a number of different genetic disorders that were considered autism for a while, and now we recognize that they are their own genetic syndromes, not necessarily just autism. So things like that have changed. And in the version of the DSM that happened around 2007, there was a switch from having subcategories of autism, which included Asperger's, pervasive developmental disorder, autism or autistic disorder, and put them all together into one label of autism spectrum disorder. And the reason for doing that was valid. Scientifically, if you took one clinic, they would use the same criteria and label someone with Asperger's in one clinic and autism in a different clinic, right? And using the same criteria, well-trained clinicians, it was more of like a judgment call almost. So, but what they found was happening was that the insurance access or the access to services was different if you had autistic disorder versus if you had Asperger's disorder. And it just made no sense from a scientific perspective. It made no sense from an access perspective. And so they made the decision to put everything under one umbrella and also streamline some of the criteria and add some new criteria. So what ended up happening as a result of this new DSM-5 is that it got very what we call heterogeneous, which means autism was then, because it was so broad, you could have someone that had an aversion to a specific noise in a specific place, to someone who was not speaking, had severe cognitive disabilities, who had self-injury, challenging behaviors, dangerous behaviors, being put into the same category as someone who, may have certain sensory sensitivities, but in fact, were living quite independently, were able to take care of themselves, able to get competitive employment, may have deficits in daily living skills, but have like amazing intelligence and be able to somewhat function. So it made it very difficult from a scientific perspective to say, okay, well, this helps people with autism, because there were so many different, say, types of autism. There were people that were exhibiting severe self-injury. There were people who were flapping their arms, right? So that's both considered a restrictive and repetitive behavior. But if you think about those two things, someone that's just flapping their hands versus someone that is banging their head against the wall, they're actually very different. So there was an effort a few years ago, not necessarily, earlier than The Lancet, that was kind of spurred on by the Lancet themselves said, listen, we're going to get a group of people together and you guys are going to talk about the challenges in autism research and talk about what needs to happen to advance autism research forward. One of the things, there were many things that came out of this paper, including some, basic tenets about, come from where you are. Not every country in the world has access to, well-trained behavioral therapists, right? So in other countries, how would you go about helping people with autism? It may not look the same. In certain socioeconomic stratus, even in the United States, things may not look the same. So the other thing was the heterogeneity. And everyone who was part of this Lancet Commission was like, yeah, this is a real issue. Not only is my child or myself or my family member not receiving the care that they need, people perceive autism as something different than it is. So this was just, a huge challenge. And so one of the things that the Lancet Commission published about was the need for possibly classifiers or descriptors of autism that better labeled their needs than what was currently being done. The other thing I should say about the DSM-5 is while it broadened the definition, it also created the opportunity for people to add what are known as clinical specifiers and severity levels. So you would say you had autism spectrum disorder, level 3 with intellectual disability or something like that. So you know, but people aren't using them. They're not being used. They're not being utilized. It seems to be too complicated. People still don't understand what all those things need. Even the language within that, those different levels of autism or those specifiers became highly controversial. So there was a decision by the Lancet Commission made that maybe there needs to be a better descriptor. And that's where profound autism came out. People didn't like the term high functioning and low functioning. They didn't like the word severe. So that was where the word profound came from. And it's a descriptor to indicate individuals who are going to need 24/7 care throughout their life. These are individuals who are cognitively disabled. They have minimal verbal ability or are non-speaking, who probably will need some sort of care. It could be in a residential facility. It could be 24/7 nursing care. It could be in some way like having an aide or having either a parent or someone at the house all the time to prevent things like wandering, to make sure that those individuals have, you know, proper care during the day, to make sure that they're able to access what they need because they cannot express themselves verbally. So that was where, that's how we've started, what's where it started, right? The descriptors are now to describe this group is an IQ less than 50 or being minimally verbal or non-communicative. So the severe and challenging behaviors aren't necessarily a part of it, but those with profound autism who are in this group with cognitively disabled, severely cognitively disabled and minimally verbal, really most of those have some severe and challenging behaviors of some sort. So the goal is to create a label and possibly a diagnosis, we're not there yet, that is distinct so that the care and support can be more personalized. And at the same token, there may be a label or a diagnosis of autism that people feel more apply to them. It may be that their daily living skills are not so great, but their intellectual ability is okay. That in fact, you know, competitive employment is a good option for them. Independent housing is a good option for them. Working on skills like daily living skills is more feasible and effective for them versus those who, you know, are in this profound group. So it's really all about getting people the care that they need. I do know, however, that there has been some backlash about it. I can't tell you that it's not a diagnosis yet. Everyone is still under the autism diagnosis. Right now, it is a label. There's a number of things that need to happen first before it becomes its own diagnosis.
Hey there, we're going to take a quick break and talk about some of the upcoming webinars that are happening over at behavioruniversity.com. These are very, very popular and very frequently they sell out. So if you go to behavioruniversity.com and click on ABA webinars and you see something you like, you're going to want to jump on that really fast. Here's a couple there's a bunch of really great ones to choose from. I'm just picking a couple here to talk about. Here's one that's coming up around the corner on April 11th. It's going beyond the task list with instructional design, a deep dive into different kinds of learning. And that's with Dr. Andrew Bulla. There's another one with Dr. Nicole Heal called Preschool Life Skills, Design, Implementation, and Extensions. And here's one about a topic that impacts, well, just about everyone. On July 10th, there'll be a webinar called Sleep Programming, What You Thought You Knew by Emily Veron, who is a former guest on the show, by the way. So if you want to learn more about that, just go to behavioruniversity.com. And if you want to save a few bucks at checkout, use the special promo code. You can find that at behavioruniversity.com/observations. All right, let's get back to the interview.
I want to get to that, but I want to let the listeners know that if they haven't heard it, we did an episode. It's session 248 with Drs. Whitney NC and Elizabeth Sheridan, where we went through the kind of, I guess, modern diagnostic standards for autism spectrum disorder. And so if people want a little bit of a primer on that, they can go back and check that episode out. We talked about the, you know, kind of best practices for diagnosis. You know, we talked a little bit about some of the diagnostic categories. We touched on profound autism. So this is a great kind of like part two and deeper dive into that topic. So one of the many reasons I'm glad you're here talking about this, but I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes for this episode. I'll also put a link to the Lancet Commission paper as well. What do we know about the about the, I guess, the distribution of individuals with profound autism versus the, I guess, the larger pool of people with the broader umbrella diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. About what percent of those individuals have profound autism?
So that's a great question. So the reality is that because there hasn't been a label so far, or there hasn't been criteria, people are having to take the information they have from current from their current groups, and then backfill that and say, like, okay, well, how many of them were minimally verbal or non-speaking? How many of them had an IQ less than 50? So the numbers on that range, there's a range anywhere between 10% to 40%. The CDC did a study. So the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, is the group that monitors how many people in the United States have autism. And every 2 years, they go into schools and they ask the schools, they pay the schools. Schools don't do this for free, to go in and say, okay, how many students do you have? How many of your students have autism? How many are getting services for autism? How were they diagnosed? Like, all of those different questions, and they're able to estimate a prevalence. So the CDC used a similar technique to go in and find out how many people had profound autism. And that number of autism, not of the community, obviously of the community, of autism was about 25%. So it seems like, and that number, just like numbers, you know, from the CDC, vary according to state. They, of course, you know, you'll see more profound autism where you see more autism in general. So it's about 20% of individuals have a label of profound autism. The other interesting thing to note is that in the community, right? So there is a 4-to-1 ratio of boys to girls. So there's a whole other podcast about why that is, but in almost every study that you see, there are more boys diagnosed with autism than there are girls. When you get to profound autism, those who have severe intellectual disability or are non-speaking, there's actually more girls than boys, just about almost one to one, maybe a few more girls than boys. So there's a different makeup. It's 25%, but there's not that sex difference or that discrepancy in diagnosis where there's more boys than girls. There's an equal number of boys and girls, maybe a little few more girls, but not that many more girls. So that's interesting.
That is really interesting. You know, and I think if you hold the random clinician off the street and ask them to guess, that they would probably give the former rather than the latter figure, meaning that they would, for those with profound autism, they would probably guess that there'd be more boys than girls, just given the broader statistic that you mentioned. And, you know, that added with whatever anecdotal experience people kind of soak up along the way.
Yeah, there is a whole nother podcast about that. It sure turns out that girls with autism have more, like, what we call a higher genetic load. So they actually have more gene variation than boys. And in fact, there's a theory that there's something going on where girls who may not show all the obvious features of autism may be underdiagnosed. This kind of, you know, has us thinking about the male to female ratio, and then also where those differences are coming from, right? So what's going on biologically in the profound autism group that would make them very interesting to study the male-female differences?
Fascinating. And I am really trying to restrain myself from going down that rabbit hole.
We won't talk about that. But
yeah, maybe we could put a pin in that and come back to that at a different time.
Yes, we could come back to that. I'm happy to be on another podcast or recommend someone who could talk about it.
Great, great. Yeah, because there's so many directions we can go with that, for sure. And I'm trying to withstand the impulse to jump right through that, right into that rabbit hole.
All right, we will indeed resist going into that rabbit hole, and we're going to take a quick break here to talk about the University of Cincinnati Online. And they know balancing work and life can be difficult, and that's why UC Online designed a Master's in Education and Behavior Analysis program that is 100% online and asynchronous. And that means you log on when it works for you. Their student success coordinators will work with you from start all the way until graduation to ensure you are receiving the support you need. Graduate in as few as 5 semesters from a top 10 program in total number of graduates and prepare for the BCBA exam. The program is FAFSA eligible. And UC also offers a business partnership program to offer tuition discounts to eligible employees. If you want to learn more, go to online.uc.edu and click the request info button. All right, let's get back to the rest of this interview.
There's a great event coming up called the Profound Autism Summit, and that's happening in Burlington, Mass. I believe it's on April 5th, which is right around the corner.
It is, April 5th. Yeah, yeah. And if you haven't signed up for it, I hear that they're almost sold out. So
ooh,
you might
okay.
Go
all right. Like adding a bit of urgency, adding some urgency to the to the call to action. I love it. Great. Well, that's that speaks to something right there. And there's probably a lot more to say about that as well. But this seems to be a really great event. And I'll have some links to the event in the show notes as well. If people want to learn more about it. If it happens to be sold out as well, I also recommend that people go to the website and sign up for the mailing list, because there's lots of good information about the stuff that, that gets published. And I know a lot of these sessions, I believe the idea is that some or all of these sessions will be available for asynchronous participation down the road and in an on-demand format. Don't hold me to that, but I think that's what the plan is at a certain point. So you're giving a talk about profound autism. So I don't want you to kind of, and you've already shared a lot of information about it, and I don't want you to give away your entire talk. We want, again, we want a full sellout, right? And we want to incentivize folks to attend. And there's also tons of other great talks as well. It's a multi-track event, and it's kind of a who's who, not just in the area of diagnostics, but we've got, you know, there are people speaking from very diverse areas in the broader context of supporting individuals with autism, from behavior analysts and people from the, you know, emergency services community, from the advocacy communities and things along those lines. So there's lots of this, a little something for everyone there. So having sufficiently, I hope, pitched the event again, what tell us a little bit about the theme of your talk.
So I am going to talk about the science around profound autism, specifically, again, the kind of the story that I told. So I kind of did let some stuff slip, but how we got to the label of profound autism and how the diagnosis has changed over time. And then also some of what we know about some of the scientific features of people with profound autism. You know, this has been a real struggle because, to be honest with you, it gets harder and harder to include people with profound autism into research, right? As the spectrum has broadened and included individuals who are in fact verbal, who don't have a cognitive disability, who in fact can sit still in a scanning machine, who can participate in a clinical trial, who can sign their own assent, all of these things makes it kind of easier to study that group of people. And so there's been a switch away in the past, you know, 40 years from the original diagnosis of autism to what is known as autism today. And then fewer and fewer researchers actually studying those who would be designated as profound autism. It's racked with logistical challenges, right? So it includes the things that I mentioned. It includes even like not just sitting still, but also like getting, you know, paying attention. And I know this is difficult in a lot of people, but if you can't, you know, if there are things that some things can't even be measured. So this is just a challenge and it's worth doing, but it's a challenge. And so these individuals have been left out of research traditionally in the last, say, 30 years, for the reasons I mentioned. So there's actually not a lot of research that compares those with profound autism to those with autism without a profound label. So there is some stuff, and I'm going to present on what is known in that stuff, but it's really not necessarily, we need to do better. We need to do better by including individuals in research, and we need to do better by making sure that they can participate. And one of the things that the Autism Science Foundation has done is create a grant mechanism specifically to improve their ability to participate in research. So techniques to monitor things in the classroom that may, you know, that may be helpful for people that do not speak or cannot communicate their needs or their emotional dysregulation. Ways to measure biological signals that are not just non-invasive, because they're all non-invasive, but one of the things that people are finding is this electrical activity in the brain is a lot different. But to measure it, you have to put all these different probes on the skull, and they're not sticking in or anything. They're just stuck on there with like a little bit of gel. So it doesn't hurt. My daughter's had several of them. But people, I mean, if you can't tolerate it and if you can't communicate about it, you just rip it off. And so it's techniques to kind of include them in research, like, you know, ways to make those kind of tests more palatable to them, ways to improve their lives so they can participate in research more. We have created that mechanism, and I'll present a little bit about what some of those grants are as well.
Outstanding. I look forward to hearing a lot more about that and hearing a lot more about the other talks as well at the Profound Autism Summit on Friday, April 5th. So, all right, very cool. And again, I'll have links to where people can learn more about that, whether to sign up for it, or if you're not in the broader New England area or don't feel like making the trip out here or can't for some reason, how to learn about getting access to this information down the road. So, My understanding is that not everyone is psyched about the profound autism, I guess, movement or diagnosis and things like that. There's some criticisms that are out there. I've read a few articles on it that, you know, some people are like, hey, tap the brakes, you know, and on this. Are you familiar with some of these critiques? If so, how would you characterize them? And I'm also curious, you know, have some of these critiques given you perhaps some reflection, or is there some charitable interpretation of these critiques, or are there, you know, or should these be challenged in some way? So, and that's kind of a broad question for you, but I'm just curious what the general reaction to the introduction of this kind of potential diagnostic category, I suppose, would be.
Yeah, I thank you for asking that, because yes, there has been some backlash about it. There was some backlash when Asperger's, which is known, was the designation for people that had awkward but odd speech, right? So they would have typically a normal cognitive ability, but awkward, really maybe limited, but, you know, kind of odd, socially awkward speech. When that designation was removed from the DSM-4 in the new DSM-5, and everything became autism spectrum disorder, there was a similar backlash. There was individuals who said, we don't want you to eliminate, you're eliminating, don't get rid of us, meaning people with Asperger's syndrome. You're trying to get rid of us. You're trying to minimize us. And so there was definitely that backlash. And I think that there's that backlash whenever there's a change in, you know, diagnostic standards. I think that there's a huge fear of stigma. So people feel that there was a stigma. They didn't feel a stigma associated with Asperger's. They did feel a stigma associated with autism. Now when that group came together, there's been a huge fight to reduce the stigma against autism. And people feel like that the profound label reintroduces that stigma. So I would argue, I strongly feel that that's not the case. So that I understand where that comes. I do kind of understand it. I know people don't, with an autism diagnosis, don't want to be stigmatized. But I think that people need to consider what they consider to be autism in themselves may not be autism in every single person. And this is what I've seen, is that I don't have intellectual disability. That's not part of me. That's just creating a subcategory for people to stigmatize and say, we don't want to become a part of that group. We don't want to even be a part of that group. We consider ourselves part of the larger autism community. So I don't agree with that, but I have listened to those arguments, because I think that we need to think about where stigma comes from and address it as a community, and not just say, okay, well, we don't want to be further stigmatized, or that label is stigmatizing, without really even understanding where the stigma comes from. There's another kind of criticism that, and this comes from a place, I think, you know, a fear, right? And I get this one. I have a daughter who is non-profound, so I totally understand this one, that there's a fear that services will be chopped up so much that people with profound autism are going to receive all the attention and all the services. And in fact, those with non-profound autism may lose access to services because profound autism will be considered what autism is. And then those without profound autism will just kind of be left behind. And I can completely, I understand that. Again, I see a way out of that, but I don't necessarily, but I sympathize with that one, right? Because we're all struggling all the time for services and supports. And so when there's a fear of those things being taken away, and that was the fear during when the DSM changed, right? There was a fear that people who were no longer considered Asperger's, that they would lose all their services and supports. And that didn't happen. I mean, people just made sure that didn't happen. And it really didn't. There were a lot of studies that were done and that didn't happen. So I think that there's that fear there. And I kind of understand that fear. You know, there is a limited finite amount of money to help people with autism. It's more than what is available to help people with intellectual disability. So, you know, I think we ought to think about that. And I just feel like that's also a solvable problem. But really, from a scientific perspective and also from a services perspective, the one-size-fits-all scenario just is not working anymore. We've seen over and over again where there's been really problems within the community that have affected public policy, especially around housing and employment, that do that kind of embrace this one-size-fits-all kind of approach. And that's just really not the way to go. People with profound autism may not be able to get competitive employment. We cannot get rid of supported employment options just because they don't fit everyone. They do fit some people. We cannot get rid of group housing or residential facilities because they're not appropriate for some people with autism. They are appropriate for some people with autism, and we should preserve the right for people to choose those options. I think that, and we can talk about this in a minute, I think with the growth of the neurodiversity movement and thinking about how everyone may be on a spectrum of behavioral or cognitive or even, you know, differences across the spectrum, I think maybe we've gone a little bit overboard and not identified thinking about, okay, everyone's just got a difference. And then maybe thought about, not really thought about, okay, well, some people have differences, but also need supports in a way that other people don't need them. And I think we've maybe, or some, you know, we have lost sight of that. I'm not saying everyone listening has lost sight of that. I'm just saying that there are groups that have lost sight of that. And I think this profound label reintroduces the idea that not everyone has the same type of needs. And it's not a judgment call. It's not a more than or less than. It's a completely different sort of needs.
Hey everyone, as a BCBA, meeting your continuing ed needs can be challenging at times. That's why I have made selected episodes of the Behavioral Observations podcast available for Type 2 continuing education credits. That's right. You can meet a portion of your professional development requirements on the go. Currently, we have CEs for topics including functional assessment, ethics, and supervision. Come learn from podcast favorites such as Greg Hanley, Pat Fryman, Mark Dixon, as well as many other amazing guests. For more information, head on over to behavioralobservations.com/get CEs.
A lot of good points there. You know, I think sometimes these conflicts maybe arise when you're trying to reconcile perhaps the social model versus a medical or scientific understanding of different disability categories as well. That kind of, you know, a just difference, if you will, versus, you know, some sort, you know, a DSM or otherwise medical diagnosis. So, you know, I'm, you know, in some of these, in some respects, I'm a kind of a both sides around some of these things. I can appreciate the, and I'm glad you brought it up in terms of the concern about the potential for funding for supports for people who, regardless of where they fall on the spectrum, you know, because I'm aware of the argument that, you know, some people who have very well developed language and cognitive skills will nonetheless say, hey, I have challenges, and I think my challenges are actually kind of profound because of, you know, these other, you know, and they'll list out a number of challenges that they might have. So I can see how some folks might bristle against the notion of classifying one population's needs as profound when they're facing everyday challenges themselves. I think I, you know, forced to choose that said, I do, I guess I under the needs of those who will, you know, unfortunately, you know, never live independently, will need constant supervision, have severe life-threatening dangerous behavior. Obviously, that's a level of profundity that's hard to top. So, you know, I guess that's perhaps where I land on that. But yeah, a lot of good points there for sure.
I want to say, like, I think it takes a certain amount of humility to say, like, my needs are not the same as someone else's needs, but yet I accept that their needs are not different. My needs may not be here, but somebody else's needs may be here. And so I think that we all need to embrace that humility to say, like, well, maybe there's somebody else with autism that doesn't meet the diagnosis of profound, right? Or the label of profound. That doesn't mean that person is more or less than. It means that they're different and that we all need to kind of take a more of a humble perspective on the needs of other people and to say, you know, we're not making a judgment here. We're saying, you know, we're coming from completely different perspectives and we need to honor those perspectives. I see that also in use of language around autism. I see a lot of individuals who consider themselves neurodiverse saying we should only use the term autistic person. We can't use the term person with, when that comes from their own perspective, right? That's their preference. When you really look at if you poll people, they actually don't care. And actually there are a group of people who are very vocal that prefer autistic or identity first, and that's fine. I think we should all be prepared to be flexible in language. But that doesn't mean you can't use person first. And so I think we all have to take some humility and realize that my perspective is not the same as yours. My life experience is not the same as yours, and yours is not the same as mine. And I think that that's just something we have to constantly remind ourselves, right? In this kind of always dog fight of trying to get services and supports and understanding and acceptance and awareness. We're always feeling like we're in a fight, that maybe we should take a step back from each other and take a breath.
I couldn't have said that better myself. That was a really excellent point. I do worry about people generating rigid rules, you know, particularly around speech as it relates to how we talk about these sorts of things. I have heard that polling folks indicates that it's not really, you know, some people prefer, some people, you know, one type of, you know, how we label these sorts of things versus other strategies. I guess, you know, from just speaking, and this might be just a testament to my age that is, you know, advancing in that the, you know, when I was coming up in the field, a person first was just drilled into us, you know, and it's almost like it's really difficult to unwind that spring in many respects. And I have colleagues who do a lot of work in the substance use disorder areas, and that what they're trying to do is kind of in that world is purge the vocabulary of things like addict, alcoholic, and things like that, and use terms like person with a substance use disorder or a alcohol use disorder. So you'll see terms like AUD or SUD in the scientific literature and the clinical literature about individuals with, you know, who have these challenges, rather than referring to people as addicts or alcoholics and things like that, which is, you know, and at the same time, I have plenty of friends and colleagues who are in recovery and they call themselves alcoholics. They call themselves addicts and things like that as well. So it is this kind of mixed bag transcends autism in many respects. And it just, I guess, points to the messiness of language
I think it does. And there's certainly words that we don't want. There are pejorative, right? And we don't want to use the R word for one.
Sure.
Right? So mental retardation kind of turned into a pejorative word for people with intellectual disability. And I'm not saying we need to go back to that. And I'm not saying we need to, you know, perpetuate some sort of language or slang that is derogatory. I would be highly against that.
Sure.
But I think that if people felt more connected to a person first vernacular, then we should respect that the same way that, you know, many times I will be talking about or to employment issues and autism, and those who are gainfully employed and competitively employed normally prefer to use identity first. And so I will use identity first. I think I have the problem with individuals in the community saying that I am being insulting or demeaning by using person first language, when in fact person first language is, you know, maybe it's not universally accepted. Maybe people prefer identity first. That's okay. There are still people that prefer person first. And, you know, I think we just need to be humble and respectful. But yes, I mean, I can see where alcoholic, junkie, you know, that sort of thing is considered pejorative. So I have no problem getting rid of that. And there may be new words that are generated that become slang and pejorative. And so let's stop using them. But the issue is stigma, and this has been studied, the stigma of for people with autism doesn't come from whether someone is person first or identity first. This has been shown experimentally. That's not where stigma comes from. So we need to address the areas of stigma because it's not from the language used.
Got it. Awesome. I know we have a limited amount of time here. And so I want to return to the topic of, again, your wonderful podcast. And in case anyone missed it at the beginning of the show, it's the ASF Weekly Science Podcast. And it's, as far as I can tell, available just pretty much anywhere you get podcasts. So I wonder, what are there some... I've been binging the back catalog of it since I've discovered it. So it's been really fun. I feel like I've gotten to know you vicariously in many respects. I know people sometimes will say that to me when I meet them at conferences as well. So it's podcasting's a pretty unique medium in that way. But
yes,
are there some particular episodes that you think the listeners you'd like to draw their attention to that come to mind?
So now that I've used the word humility, so I always prefer podcasts where I have guests on it. And you know, as much as I do, to have a guest, you have to plan ahead. You have to schedule a time. It takes a little bit more finagling. So I can't always get guests, but I would target the ones that, and in the podcast, I guess they're called notes. I call them summaries. I will say today's guest is. So anyone where there is a guest, I think is better. And I actually really love talking to Dr. Andrew Whitehouse about a theory about autism where it's emergent and transactional. So it bridges both the medical and social models of autism, that you're born with autism, that it comes from brain miswiring, that there's certain levels of functioning that occur because of this brain miswiring, but then also it can be shaped throughout development through things like access to intervention, access to behavioral interventions, contextual factors, the community that you live in, that it's not, you know, you're just born with it and that's the way you end with it, because it changes over time. It depends on your context, your environment, the interventions you receive. So he's a researcher in Australia, in case you haven't heard of him before, who really does everything. He helped write the national plan for Australia for autism. He works in biology. He works in behavioral interventions. He works in cognitive, the understanding of people with autism. And talking to him was a real treat. And so if you can, I don't remember the date of that, but if you go to the ASF podcast site, you can do a search for Andrew Whitehouse. I've got him tagged. So that was a real treat. I also interviewed someone again to talk about catatonia. So I try to touch on issues in the podcast that may seem to be overlooked, right? So I'll try and get speakers to talk about issues that are overlooked. And one of the things, it's considered a mental health comorbidity, but I think that it's a little bit more intense than just a mental health comorbidity. It's catatonia. So individuals with autism, especially those with rare genetic disorders in autism, have a higher risk of developing catatonia, which can be anything from, you know, something that's transient and somewhat mild to anything that's permanent and life-threatening. So this can be changes in mood, changes in psychiatric function, changes in motor, changes in motivation, that can be deadly to people with autism. And so I think it's often overlooked. It's terribly misdiagnosed. And psychiatrists know all about it, but there's not enough psychiatrists to go around in this country. Think about what it's like in other countries. And so it's often misunderstood. And so the goal of any of my podcasts is to, you know, even provide a little bit of seed of knowledge to better understand the community and the research that's out there. You don't have to completely understand everything. Nobody does. And so I also try to have people who can talk broadly about different issues to help simplify things. But those are the two that I can remember in the past 12 months that I really enjoyed.
All right. And is that Catatonia one? Is that an interview or is that a solo episode?
It's an interview with someone at the, let me just quickly look. It's with Dr. Martine Lamy at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. It was November 5th of last year. And the title was Nobody Ever Talks About Catatonia. And the Andrew Whitehouse one, which was just really a joy, was July 30th of last year. And it's called Emergent and Transactional with Dr. Andrew Whitehouse.
Outstanding. Yeah. I'll put links to those episodes in the show notes for this one. And for those who don't know, you can go to behavioralobservations.com and find extensive show notes to this episode and all the others. And if you join the mailing list, I send the show notes out to you. So it'll just come right to your inbox.
Okay.
So very cool. Very cool. I'm not sure if I caught those ones. So I'll definitely look those up.
They were a while ago. I mean, they were last year.
Yeah.
So
fascinating.
Definitely have plans for future interviews in the next year. And so that's great. And I'll probably podcast about the summit, although I won't give everything away because I want people to go.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely want to podcast about that.
So people, if they want to learn more about, you can go to the autism or what you do at the Autism Science Foundation, and just go to Autism Science Foundation, and that's .org.
Yes. And then the podcast is asfpodcast.org. Right. We didn't want to, you know this, but if you put a podcast on a regular website, it will crash quickly. So we've separated them out.
Very good. All right. This has been a really fun conversation. I learned a lot and I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. It was a real joy. I look forward to meeting you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Behavioral Observations Podcast with Matt Sikoria. You can find Matt's notes on this episode at www.behavioralobservations.com. We also invite you to stay connected with us on Facebook at facebook.com/behavioralobservations and on Twitter @behaviorpodcast.